It's the Famous Monsters Podcast, the official podcast of Famous Monsters of Filmland Magazine.
Welcome to the Famous Monsters Podcast, the official podcast of Forrest J. Ackerman's classic magazine that started it all back in 1958. Often imitated, never duplicated, and more than just monsters, we cover sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and all kinds of genre pop culture, living up to Forrest's classic roots while staying current and ahead of the curve.
David!
What?
Now, I'm really sorry to be upsetting you, but I have to warn you.
Warn me?
We were attacked by a werewolf.
I'm not listening to this.
On the moors, we were attacked by a lycanthrope, a werewolf. I was murdered, an unnatural death, and now I walk the earth in limbo until the werewolf's curse is lifted.
Shut up.
The wolf's bloodline must be severed. The last remaining werewolf must be destroyed. It's you, David.
What?
Please believe me. You'll kill people.
Nurse!
Listen to me!
Nurse!
The supernatural. The power of darkness. It's all true. The undead surround me. Have you ever talked to a corpse? It's boring.
I'm David Weiner, editor of Famous Monsters magazine, and that's a clip from An American Werewolf in London, John Landis' amazing, unpredictable, spectacular horror film that's now a classic. The film is celebrating its 35th anniversary, hard to believe, and it's one of my all-time favorites. It's a hugely, hugely influential film on me. I walked into that theater and saw that movie, and I thought I knew what to expect, and I completely played with my expectations and delivered a deft mix of horror and humor and an amazing, amazing special makeup effects by Oscar winner Rick Baker. And watching that movie now, 35 years later, it ages extremely well. And we decided to reunite not only Rick Baker and John Landis, but Jenny Agutter, David Naughton, and Griffin Dunn, the three leads of the film, for the pages of Famous Monsters magazine. You can check out this great American Werewolf reunion in the pages of Famous Monsters magazine. The new issue is on stands now. It's issue number 284. You can find it at newsstands and Barnes & Noble, online at famousmonsters.com or captainco.com, or even digitally at Magster, magzter.com, to check it out. For this podcast today, I thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to play some of my interview with John Landis and some of my interview with Rick Baker. I had wonderful conversations with both of these amazing filmmakers, and we spoke for practically an hour for each conversation. And so rather than play that unedited, I've got a taste of each. First, we're going to be playing John Landis, and then we're going to be playing some Rick Baker. Please be aware that there's a little salty language here and there, so don't be surprised. But these guys tell some spectacular tales. John Landis and Rick Baker are going to be joined by David Naughton this March up in Santa Rosa, California, at Famous Monsters' own Silver Scream Fest. They're going to be talking about the movie. We're going to be screening An American Werewolf in London, and it's going to be a pretty exciting weekend. So you can go to silverscreamfest.com to get more information all about that. There's Q&A screenings with those guys. We're also going to be remembering the late Wes Craven with Nightmare on Elm Street stars Robert Englund and Heather Langenkamp. And also, Bela Lugosi Jr. is going to be there. It's the 85th anniversary of Dracula. So he's going to be talking about his legendary father, and there's going to be so much more. So please go to silverscreamfest.com to check all of that out. Stay tuned. Here's my interview with John Landis, and afterwards, my interview with Rick Baker. Please enjoy.
The premise of An American Werewolf in London, I mean, the real key to the movie for me was, how do you make something unreal, real? I mean, a premise, you know, a guy turns into a werewolf at the full moon, is not true. It's impossible. The supernatural does not exist. So you have to create in the story, in the movie you're watching, or the book you're writing, or whatever whatever the vehicle is, what's called suspension of disbelief.
Right.
And so I figured the way to do that was have this story happen. It's, you know, deeply inspired by Kurt Siodmak's screenplay for The Wolfman, the Lon Chaney Wolfman, because, he did a remarkable thing in The Wolfman, which is that's the first time a lycanthrope, a werewolf, was a victim. I mean, the curse is like a disease. It's like he gets cancer. And what's fascinating about Kurt Siodmak's Wolfman, the character Chaney played, I think, five times,
Right.
Chaney Jr., is that he's not only a victim, the monster is not him. You know, in Jekyll and Hyde, that's the evil part of Hyde. You know, the evil part of Dr. Jekyll. It's part of his personality that comes out, the animal in him, you know, by these drugs. It's like psychopharmacology. And in every other thing, Dracula can turn into a wolf. He turns himself into a wolf, mainly to be malevolent. And witches traditionally can turn themselves into wolves. It just was so fascinating that he wasn't a bad guy. He's always waking up going, what did I do last night?
Right.
He's just totally a victim. And in fact, also the through line in all those Wolfman movies is he's trying to kill himself, usually. So I took that idea, okay, they're victims of something that's impossible. And that's why the movie's funny. Because in my experience, an educated person's response to the supernatural is to laugh at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the
disbelief.
Well, not only disbelief, but suspicion, and that can't be real. You know, it's ridiculous. And the example I've used 1,000 times is you and your friend go to a movie now, so you're at the multiplex, and you come out, and you enjoyed yourselves, and your friend pokes you and says, look at that guy. And there's a guy crossing the street, and he's got, you know, this long black hair that's got grease in it, puffed up in a big pompadour, and he's wearing a velour cape, better yet, a satin cape, and he's wearing white pancake makeup and dark eyeliner and red lipstick, and he comes up to you and he says, I want to drink your blood. Well, you're laughing.
Right.
That's your response. That's how you, because it's ridiculous. And if the guy attacks you and you're on your back in the gutter, and he's literally tearing your throat out with his teeth, you're in pain, you're in shock, there's surprise, and you're dead. But not once would it even occur to you, this is the undead. This is a vampire. This is a creature who lives by sucking your blood. Because it's not true. You're still dead. Your throat's torn out. He's drinking away, but it makes no sense. So it's funny. That's how we react to stuff. You know, I mean, that's the success of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, or Richard Pryor, or so many people, you know, Bob Hope, that comedy of fear, you know, and what's called nervous laughter.
Yes.
And so The American Werewolf, which it's always bothered me, I know it's silly of me, but it's always bothered me that it's called a comedy horror, because it's, I never think of it as a comedy. It's actually quite dark and ends badly, and but it's very funny. And I think, I'm hoping that the funniness of it, the humor of it, makes it more horrific. That was my intention.
Oh, yeah. Oh, maybe they could have marketed, you know, the post-marketing as the nervous laughter horror.
Oh, I'd be terrified, be horrified if they did that. No, I actually liked the original campaign, the poster of David and Jack kind of looking over their shoulders nervously.
Sure.
And it said, the line was, from the director of Animal House, a different kind of animal.
Yes. Right.
You know, but it's a monster movie.
And then, so this was the foundation that you were... That was,
well, I actually wrote the script when I was 18. I wrote it in Yugoslavia.
Oh, so you went straight to pen and, you know, pen and
oh,
paper.
Yeah. No, I wrote it. I did. I started, you know, doing a lot of thinking and researching about, you know, different kinds of monsters. And I just found the werewolf to be a fairly international creature. Only ghosts, really, are as ubiquitous in world culture. And I was, you know, man into animal thing. I mean, even science fiction, like The Island of Dr. Moreau, there's all kinds of interesting man into animal things. But this was different. This was really creepy. And I just borrowed and based it on mythology and screenplays. I mean, that's I think the real innovation in werewolf, now it's commonplace. They call it postmodern. But, I mean, in werewolf, those characters had seen the Wolfman. I mean, they make
sure.
Movie references. You know, now it's done all the time. But then it was something new.
Well, going back to some of your ideas that initially that were in the script, and it seems like you stuck to a T to your script. Was
exactly. There's only one change. There's only one. I think that's part of the movie's charm. Used to bother me, but now I think it kind of works. But it's because it's clearly written by an 18-year-old. I mean, the way the guys relate to each other, their dialogue and stuff, it's pretty authentic because that's who I was when I wrote it. And, I mean, the nurse, the whole thing with Jenny, it's a tribute to her because it's such a fantasy of a young boy to have this gorgeous English rose nurse sort of take him in. And she managed to make that character real.
Oh, very, very three-dimensional.
Yeah, which is great.
And there are lots of wonderful little moments between the two.
Oh, absolutely. She's, you know, she's terrific, Jenny. And there were the only real difference between the finished movie and the original screenplay is, well, two things. One, the metamorphosis was supposed to, it was written to take place in bright light, and I always had that Sam Cooke music, Blue Moon, playing. And, but I wanted to do it without any cutaways.
Mm.
And I ended up doing a cutaway to Mickey Mouse just because it amused me. But the
well,
other
I laugh even now. It was a great cut.
But the other change was there were these, unfortunately, now they're gone completely, but there used to be for many years, these small cinemas scattered around London, and they were called cartoon cinemas or newsreel cinemas. And there was one, the Eros in Piccadilly Circus. There's one in, one up at Marble Arch and one in Victoria Station. There were like eight of them, and they were little theaters where they just showed cartoons and newsreels and commercials, and parents would drop their kids off at these cartoon cinemas while they went shopping on the high street.
Hmm.
And I saw that for the first time in 1969, the first time I was in London on my way to Yugoslavia. And then I was in London quite a bit. In 1975, I was one of the many writers of a James Bond movie called The Spy Who Loved Me. And so I was in London for a long time, like 3 or 4 months or something. And I used to go every week to the cartoon cinemas, and they all thought I was nuts. But, you know, this is before home video, and the cartoon cinemas showed wonderful 35-millimeter prints of Chuck Jones, you know, Bob Clampett, Tex Avery, I mean, all these great Warner Brothers and Disney cartoons and MGM cartoons, and I loved seeing them because they were totally unavailable at that time. And so I wrote it to be in the Eros cartoon cinema, and it was same theater, but it was written to be that on screen was a Roadrunner cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would be the same sequence, only it'd be a Roadrunner cartoon, and the other people in the theater would be children. So when he turns and says, "Go away," it would be to a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came back to London to make the movie in 1981, much to my surprise, I found that most of the cartoon cinemas had closed, and the Arrow Cinema was now a porno theater.
That's a radical change.
Well, it is, but it works. So that was the first thing we shot, that little British, you know, whoops, my knickers are showing kind of movie. And I remember the crew thinking, what the fuck are we, what is this?
That's the first thing you shot out of the gate, right?
Yeah, the first thing we shot was that little movie. And then that movie was actually, that's actually projected in the theater, in the set that we built.
Jenny and David and the characters have, they really have a lot of chemistry.
That's really the talent of Jenny Agutter and David Naughton. I've always felt that David, I think he's wonderful in the movie. I think he really, a lot of the success of the film is down to him and Griffin and Jenny. And very quickly, how quickly David and Griffin established their relationship.
Mm.
And, you know, a very real boys, you know. So it makes Griffin's death suddenly, or Jack's death, much more shocking.
But you have a friendship with Jenny, and before the film, and now you find yourself shooting a love scene, and you know, various places. Is that something that for you it's no big deal because it's a very technical event, or is there any apprehension on your part?
It totally depends on, well, apprehension, not really. It depends on the actors and how they feel about it, because it's, you know, it's not going to be romantic. I mean, you're shooting pieces, and it's you know, and Jenny had been, did you ever see Walkabout or
that was sort of her celebrated coming out from a child actress too,
right? She was still pretty young in that, and then in Equus, I mean, she's actually had done nudity before, so
mm-hmm. Even in Logan's Run, yeah.
But I
think, okay.
But I no, it was, you know, you just want to make the actors comfortable and try to make the sequence work.
Sure, she actually told me that at one point, I don't know if it was you or somebody was tickling her feet.
Yeah, I was trying to get her to smile.
And she said that reaction is used entirely in a different context, and it works definitely well for that. Was Moondance?
Exactly, that's totally true. I'm shocked she told you that.
Oh, yeah. It was a great little moment. Was Moondance, Van Morrison's Moondance, was that always the...
That was always in the script.
Yeah. I always associate that song with that scene now. I can't not do that.
Well, I guess it's not a bad association. It's such a wonderful song.
It's a pleasant thing. It's a pleasant thing. So so you saved the Bravura transformation shoot for after the principal photography.
It was the last week.
Correct?
It was the last week of principal photography, but it meant that we had done it. You know, we were just down to David and the makeup guys
mm-hmm.
in the room. And, I you know, that was partly done to give Rick as much time as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And the other time, and the other was, you know, what do you need, Rick, to make this work? I'm sure he told you the story about, I've forgotten what effect it was, but there was one of his puppets, and, you know, we got ready, and it did whatever it did. And I said, okay, great. And Rick, let's move on. And Rick looked at me and said, that's it? Did he tell you this story?
Yeah, he's worked, you know, 10 months on this.
Exactly. He was so upset. And he goes, what? And I said, Rick, does it do anything else? He said, no. I said, then we're moving on. But he was so, it was very funny. He was so, what? Because poor Rick and David, I mean, they would start work like at 2 in the morning. And then we'd all show up at 7 and get our first shot at 8. And then they'd go away for 2 hours and we'd shoot a piece of a puppet. Then they'd come back and they'd go away for 2 hours. I think we're lucky to get 3 shots a day with David.
How was David's disposition during all this? Was he a
he was a trooper. I have to say, we put him through a lot of shit. I mean, you know, that's hard to do. And I don't think people realize how exhausting it is just to sit in a makeup chair for hours and hours, having people gluing things on your face.
Sure.
And then wearing the stuff's very uncomfortable.
Now, were you cutting this as you were going, or did you wait till the end to put it together?
No, I always cut during principal photography. I find it very helpful.
And so when you finally are cutting this sequence together, was there a little kid excitement when all these plans were coming together and it was looking so wonderful, or was it really?
I always see the problems. I very rarely, you know, it takes a long time for me to watch a movie of my own, and I mean, there's things I like, there's scenes I like in all of my films, but I just see the things that I wish had been different or better, you know. Rick will not like this, but I really feel that I show the wolf too much in the movie. Mm. I was very enamored of Rick's work. It was so amazing that I think in the finished film you see the wolf too much. The best shot in the movie is the one, the high down shot for after the guy falls on the escalator in the tube.
Right. Yeah.
And you're way high up shooting down, and the wolf makes an entrance, and it's like, holy fuck, that thing is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And you see it, but you don't really see it. You know, that's really the best.
Oh yeah.
I think that I show it too much.
Well, I feel like to a certain extent, at least there's a lot of it, and I think it's a satisfying amount. But I think like the Jaws and Bruce the Shark element of it, you know, less is more, and I think you play on that very much. Because you see all the warts and all of the project, when you're looking back at it 35 years later, do you accept it, your child, as it is, or do you still...
Oh, sure. No, I mean, first of all, it was very, very successful, so that was good. And it didn't get very... In the States, it really got kind of shitty reviews. Roger Ebert was very upset with the movie. It got pretty bad reviews, but it did pretty good business. And in Australia and the UK, it was gigantic hits. I mean, in England, it was the number two picture of the year after a James Bond. And it's still a big picture in the UK. It's they relate to it differently, you know.
Sure.
Because there are a lot of jokes about English culture and stuff. And it does capture a moment in London. And it's so funny now. I mean, there really were only three channels.
Yeah. What were you ever tempted to take on a sequel after the?
I wrote a sequel. The PolyGram came to me 10 years later. They had fired John and Peter after they made 12 movies there, and Werewolf was the only one that made money, and so PolyGram fired them and hired a Brit. And he asked me to write a sequel, and I wrote a sequel that took place exactly 10 years after An American Werewolf in London. It had almost the entire original cast, including the dead people. And he was horrified by it. He just couldn't figure it out. He said, "This is outrageous. Outrageous." But what was true was he would have had the same reaction to the American Werewolf script. Stephen King said something once that impressed me, where somebody said to him, "Doesn't it upset you when people ruin your books? You know, turn your books into these bad movies and they ruin your books." And he said, "My books are fine. Look, they're right there on the shelf." And he's right. I mean, you know, so I realized that if someone does remake it or do a sequel or whatever, what happens if they do a good job? That's great. I mean, I think Cronenberg's remake of The Fly is great, and Carpenter's remake of The Thing is great. So, and those, you know, I think that you can do it. But if they fail, like I thought American Werewolf in Paris was terrible, it just makes me look like a genius. So, you know,
yeah.
I'm in a no-lose situation.
Sonoma County, drink it in. Wine, wilderness, and Wes Craven. Wait, what? Brace yourself, for Famous Monsters of Filmland and the Santa Rosa Entertainment Group present the Silver Scream Film and Comic Festival.
coming to Santa Rosa, March 4th, 5th, and 6th, 2016. The stars of Horrorwood will be in attendance, and they're thirsty for more than just wine. Come celebrate the 35th anniversary of An American Werewolf in London. Enjoy a tribute to Wes Craven. Witness a live makeup demonstration by the Cinema Makeup School, and that's just for starters. With special guests John Landis, Rick Baker, Robert Englund, Heather Langenkamp, David Naughton, Kevin Burns, Rob Pryor, Eric Keyes, Derek Robertson, and many more. For tickets and information, visit silverscreenfest.com. We're dying to see you there.
John Landis and Rick Baker first worked together on John's movie Schlock when they were both 21 and 20 years old. And John already had big, big plans to make American Werewolf in London. He had already written the script. He wrote it when he was 18 years old. And he said when they'd Rick Baker would be putting on applications of makeup, he'd tell Rick all about this insane werewolf script that he wanted to produce. And Rick was excited. He was on board. He was going to do it. Well, little did he know that 10 years was going to be going by before he would have an opportunity to make An American Werewolf in London. And in that time, Rick kind of, you know, he developed a bunch of amazing, amazing prosthetics and amazing what he calls change-o heads that transform from a human head into a werewolf head. But he kind of thought that this might never see the light of day, at least the work he had done. So ironically, Joe Dante was making The Howling, his own werewolf movie, and recruited Rick Baker to do it, and Rick said yes. And then, of course, timing is everything in Hollywood, and John Landis said, "So, you ready? We've got the financing. Let's do it." And Rick had a little bit of a conflict. Here he talks about it.
I know that John kind of planted the seeds about American Werewolf when you guys were working on Shock. It wasn't for years to come. You know that this was going to come to fruition. And I guess in terms of a linear fashion, it seems like you get when John finally got the financing and the green light and ready to go and everything like that, you already had committed to The Howling.
Yeah.
How was that experience where you already had wonderful ideas and didn't seem like it was ever going to happen? So here comes a werewolf movie, and then now you've got two at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the way it works in Hollywood so many times, I guess. But yeah, I mean, you know, John had already he had written the script before we made Schlock, American Werewolf, and he, as it was making him up, as just like Schlocktropist, he would, you know, would tell me the whole story and act it out, and I would usually tell him to shut up and be still because I was trying to glue an appliance on him, you know. But he told me, you know, like I said, he basically acted out the whole thing and said, you know, he wanted to see a transformation in a way that had never been done before. He said it just doesn't make sense that you would sit in a chair like Lon Chaney Jr. and be perfectly still until you transform, you know, and that. He says, "I think it would be a painful experience," and he wanted to show that pain, and he wanted that person to be able to move around, you know. And you know, we both loved all the transformation scenes, you know, the Wolfman and Hyde movies and stuff. And I was very excited by the prospect of getting to do something like this, you know. And John said, "This is going to be my next movie," you know. So start thinking about it. You know, he said, "How would you do it?" And go, "I don't know, but I'll try to figure it out because it'd be really cool." You know? So I started thinking about it and, you know, I had like 10 years to think about it because, you know, people weren't breaking down John's door to make American Werewolf. You know, Schlock was not a big commercial success by any means, you know. And,
sure.
And it wasn't until he started having films like Animal House and you know, and put him on the map more, and you know, he made him look like he was a successful filmmaker, that he, you know, ever got the money to make this. But you know, before I got the call from John, I got a call from Joe Dante and Mike Fennell saying they've got a werewolf movie, and you know, they wanted to know if I was interested. And I just, you know, I just kind of given up that, you know, I thought American Werewolf was never going to happen. And I thought up a lot of neat ways to do this transformation, and I wanted to do it, you know. So I said yes, and as you know, as it works out, I mean, shortly after I said yes, I got a call from John, and you know, he was all excited, and then I was going, oh shit, I'm going to tell him. So I just kind of, had to tell him. I said, well, John, you know, it took, you know, it was been 10 years, and I, you know, I wanted to do this transformation. I thought it was never going to happen, and I got called by, you know, this other guy about a werewolf movie, and I said I'd do it, you know, and then John starts screaming at me, you know, you asshole, you fucker, you know, and like, you know, every name he could call me, and I totally understood him being upset about it, you know, and I said, well, these are things I thought of for your movie, basically, so I really should be doing them in yours, and I'll figure out a way that I can turn this over to Rob Bottin, who was my protege, and this kid that I taught and came to me when he was 13 and as a fan, but he had never really done any makeup stuff, and I took him under my wing and taught him a bunch of stuff, and we'd work together on a number of things, and so I said, well, this is like perfect. It's be a good movie for him, and I know that he'll do a good job, and so, you know, I told him, you know, what I was planning on doing, and kind of said there were certain things that I wanted to keep for my transformation in American Werewolf, you know, and he had a lot of ideas as well for things he wanted to try, and so, you know, it turned out that I, you know, very early on, I mean, I did one sculpture, I think, before I got the call from John, I just said, you know, I talked to Joe and Mike, and they were understanding about it. I said, Rob, I think we'll do a really great job, and I'll consult with him and make sure of it, you know, and help him along the way. But I really need to, you know, work on John's movie, and they understood. So
was there an element of the transformation that you, in a sense, graciously donated to The Howling that you didn't use for American Werewolf just because you knew you wouldn't use it? Or did you kind of have to, did you feel a certain sense of obligation for select things that you had already committed to in terms of pitching the Howling transformation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I definitely, you know, like I said, I kind of held some things back. I said, the whole idea of like a change-o head and parts and stuff like that, you know, I kind of gave it that up to Rob to play with, and then also but I said, you know, there are things like I want to do the stretched out body, you know, and do a thing where he's through a hole in the set, you know, and I don't want you to do that part, and I don't want you to do this. I forget what the whole word is specifically, but you know, the difference too was, you know, the Howling, the werewolf in the Howling was a biped, in the
right,
in the werewolf in American Werewolf was, you know, quadruped, and you know, it was a naked man changing, you know, too, and in the Howling it wasn't that, you know, so it was mainly, you know, the head transforming and that kind of stuff that they focused on, you know, and it was an interesting thing because, I mean, the Howling actually did start before American Werewolf, and it actually came out before American Werewolf, and what was good about it, we were kind of in a holding pattern on Werewolf. You know, John called me right when it looked like the deal was going to happen, but it hadn't totally gone through, and there was like time, you know, where, you know, Howling was happening. So I looked at it as kind of a prototype, you know, that somebody else is paying for in a way, you know. So
sure,
you know, we
sure.
Try things, and I also knew that on Werewolf I needed a crew bigger than just me, you know, and I knew that Rob wasn't going to be available now. And there were a number of people that I was thinking about using on Werewolf that actually I had Rob use on the Howling before I needed them. So it was kind of like, I can see if these people are actually going to work out too, you know. I mean, if they don't, then I can find somebody else. But it was, you know, a different time in those days. It wasn't like there are now, where there's, you know, makeup studios all over the place with a ton of people that know how to do this stuff.
How many iterations did you go through to lock down the look of the werewolf?
Not many at all. I mean, the thing that was great about John, in what, you know, the way I thought things were going to work in the film industry, and I was very wrong, was, John says to me, "No, you're the expert at this stuff, and this is what you focus on and what you're the expert at. You know, I'm going to let you, I'm going to tell you what I want, and then you just do it." You know what I mean? But it wasn't like films have become now, where there's so many producers that want to be involved, and it was like, maybe if you move this hair over a millimeter, it'll look better, really stupid little changes and stuff. It wasn't like that with John. I mean, John, I argued with John for a while about the werewolf because I wanted to make a biped werewolf, and also I was a little concerned about, more than a little concerned, I was very concerned about doing this transformation in the brightly lit room,
Mm-hmm.
But John's point was, that's the whole point of the movie. I want it to be real. And this is happening to a real guy and in a real apartment, and it's not all of a sudden going to have horror movie lighting in it, I want it lit just like it is normally, And they said, no, I understand. It's just, there's no way to hide anything, He goes, well, then just do it right, That's why I'm giving you all this time and money, But I mean, as far as the werewolf, I was hoping to do it, biped. And he goes, no, I want it to be a four-legged hound from hell, make it, So I did one painting of a kind of a wolf-like four-legged thing, and I did a maquette of sorts that's a little more wolf-like than what it ended up being. And then I just sculpted it. Which is nice, one of the reasons I retired, besides the fact that I'm just old, and wanted to do things that I want to do for myself, was, the way the business has changed so much, there's so many people involved, and they eventually just suck the life out of you, you do so many versions of an idea, and to the point where you don't even know what the difference between the one you're doing now and the last one really is, It's just after a while, it sucks your soul out, and there's a real vitality of when you sit down at the sculpture and you know that this is what it's going to be and what you're doing is it.
I heard you say at one point that your dog was a influence on the ultimate look of this creature.
Yeah, I had this dog named Bosco. Yeah, I had these two dogs, Bosco and Kelly, and Bosco was a Keys hound, Keeshan, I think some people call him. And the
B-O-S-C-O?
Yeah, like the drink.
Yeah.
If you're old enough to really know what I'm talking about, yeah. He was there, and he was canine, and he was interesting looking, the type of dog that he was had, big mane of hair around its neck, and I kind of, as the werewolf does, mm-hmm. And there were a lot of elements, but Bosco wasn't as ferocious looking as the werewolf, but he definitely, influenced the design. And,
What would you say because you're going to be shooting, you knew you were going to be shooting in flat, bright light for the most part. Obviously, that was intimidating, but if you could single out any specific thing that really sort of gave you comfort or solace that you were going to be able to pull it off? Was it, pigmentation? Was it the select details of the sculpt? Or is it an overall sort of feel for it?
Well, I just didn't even know if I was going to be able to pull it off, I was just praying that I was going to be able to, and just to get all this stuff done as well with these, with these basically inexperienced crew members.
Some of the first things that you did were, I believe, on the Moors, the attack of on Jack. Mm-hmm. What were some of the challenges that you experienced when you were actually doing that, and some of the fears you had since you had a whole shoot and you had a lot of work to do? Were you able to work on anything else other than those scenes because you were so remote?
The hardest thing for this California boy, which I consider myself a Californian, even though I was born in New York, I lived in California
right.
since I was one, was I wasn't used to the cold, and we're filming out in, Windsor Great Park in the middle of winter, in the middle of the night, and it was cold as hell. And again, all this stuff was fairly new and fresh, and you're always, you know, kind of wondering how it's going to hold up and how it's going to work, and you're, you know, trying to be real cautious and safe with it. And when it came time to, you know, attack Griffin, you know, I said to him, you know, this is pretty fragile. You know, it's foam rubber. You know, it took us a long time to make. You know, all these hairs are individually implanted into the rubber. But, you know, I know it's supposed to be killing you, but you have to be careful with it because it can get damaged, you know. And the first take, I mean, I say this in the documentary thing, so I'm sure you've heard it, but, you know, I mean,
right.
You know, first take, you know, I'm like, you know, going after Griffin with this thing with it. And the stunt head, which looked like we had three heads for the wolf, and the stunt head, which is one that I puppeteered, we had rubber teeth for the scenes where he had to bite people, then we had hard teeth for scenes where he didn't. And in the very first take, you know, with the rubber teeth, and, you know, Griffin grabs onto the side of the face and, like, rips the face off the skull, you know, and it was like, and it's like, so, you know, first of all, I had to take my gloves off, and I had to try to find a place where I could actually see enough to glue this thing back together, and you know, it was freezing, and, you know, and it was, and the glue didn't want to work right, and it was all like, you know, it was like, God damn it, you know, brand new thing just got torn up, you know, and this is how we're going to start the movie, you know. So, you know, I thought, okay, well, if Griffin wants to play rough, I'm going to play rough, too. So I just decided I was just going to beat the crap out of him with this rubber wolf head, you know, which I think made the scene a lot better, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's really screaming because I'm pounding on him with this thing, you know. But, and, you know, and the thing was, too, with Griffin, you know, and again, this is in that documentary, but, you know, the first time I did a makeup test on him as the first stage of Jack, he just got really depressed. And I could tell as I was putting these pieces on that, you know, he was just kind of sinking lower and lower in the chair and just looking like he was going to cry, you know. And it's like, you know, what's going on, Griffin? And it's like, you know, this is my big film break, and this is what I'm going to look like, and nobody's going to look at me. And it's like, well, did you read the script? And you go, yeah, you know, doesn't it say that half of your face is, your neck is ripped off and half of your face is ripped off? And, you know, yeah, but I mean, somehow I just didn't, you know, visualize it like this, you know. It's like, well, what John and I have, and this is kind of what we've made, you know, and this is what you're going to be, you know. So, I mean, John was in England at that time, scouting locations and stuff, so I had to call him and just say, you know, we got a little bit of a problem here. Griffin's kind of real upset about what he looks like. So, you know, and so me being the caring person that I am, I decided to, since he was already in a bad mood anyways, this would be the good time to tell him that stage three Jack is actually going to be a puppet. It's not going to be. So, you know, I figured he couldn't get any more depressed than he was. You know?
Might as well lay it on thick now and know where
you stand. Yeah, and get it over with, you know. And, you know, he wasn't too pleased about that fact either, but I said, you know, but you still, I think that you should operate the mouth because you will be saying the dialogue live and you could puppeteer the mouth and, you know, and you know, so you'll still be a part of it, you know. But, I mean, Griffin, you know, after he got over the initial shock of it, was great. You know, I thought he was great in the movie and he was, you know, really good to work with and everything. He was no problem at all after that.
In terms of the disposition of David Naughton, I mean, he seemed like a true sport for this kind of stuff, but it sure does get taxing after these long hours. I mean, did he have his own little learning curve about how to approach all this time in the makeup chair, or is he pretty much at the mercy of how you guys go about things?
Yeah, he was kind of at our mercy. You know, I mean, David was a great sport. I mean, he did have, you know, the day that we did that stretched out body, it truly was like 10 hours of makeup, you know, it was ridiculously long time. And he stuck in a hole in the set, you know, I mean, once we put him in the hole in the floor, you know, with him leaning back, you know, with his shoulders on the floor and his head on the floor, but his, you know, his rib cage, you know, arching backwards into the hole in the set, with the whole stretched out body stuck on, he's stuck there, you know. And
no bathroom breaks, huh?
No. I mean, he had to go before that, and then that was it, you know. And but I mean, David was really good about dealing with it. I mean, it helped that he would have a beer or something, you know. He he just kind of, you know, I didn't paint a pretty picture of what his life was going to be. I try to be honest about what I'm going to do and what their life is going to be like. And, you know, it's kind of like I'd rather the person back out of the movie before we ever start than after we've built everything, you know, and going, I can't do this shit, you know. So, so he knew what he was getting into, and he manned up about it.
Sure, sure. Well, it's a definitely a wonderful career step up from the, you know, the making of the sitcom and the Dr. Pepper commercials. You know?
Rick Baker won his first Oscar for An American Werewolf in London with a category created specifically for the work he did on the movie. He has since retired very recently to selectively work on the things that he wants to work on. He would go on to win 7 Oscars overall for his work, with more nominations than that. If you look at our new issue of Famous Monsters of Filmland, number 284, on the cover is An American Werewolf, a wonderful painting painted exclusively by Rick for us. It's the alternate cover. On the other cover, we've got Batman versus Superman, interview with Zack Snyder, Mark Hamill, The Walking Dead's Tova Feldshaw, William Catt, Michael Dougherty, a bunch of folks. We'd love you to pick it up. We'd love you to talk about it. We'd love you to share it. You can get the new issue at CaptainCo.com or FamousMonsters.com, newsstands, Barnes & Noble, Magster, MAGZTER.com. You can get it digitally. You could also get our comics at American Gothic Press. Famous Monsters has a lot of wonderful, wonderful comics. So you could check them out at American Gothic Press. And you can also just find out what we're doing and what we're up to and find out more about the Silver Scream Fest on our various social media handles. You can go to Twitter, you can go to Facebook, Pinterest, we're on YouTube, Tumblr. Twitter is at FMOF. The American Gothic Press is AGP Monsters. I personally, I am Tiki Ambassador. Don't ask me to explain it. I probably never will. If you enjoyed this podcast and enjoy Famous Monsters magazine and our comics and the things that Famous Monsters does, please spread the word. Make sure to incorporate horror, sci-fi, fantasy, and genre pop culture into your conversations to ensure generations of monster kids to come. So until next time, thank you so much for listening. Beware the moon and stick to the road.
The Famous Monsters podcast is copyright Famous Monsters and Movieland Classics, LLC. All rights reserved.